Okay, yeah.
You know, which is kind of a lottery, right?
Yes.
We always talk about that.
That's right, that's right, yes.
You know, a certain kind of lottery. Depending on, you know, who, you know, your father and your mother.
Yes, Prince Charles still weeps.
Right,
yes.
So, you know, these are things that obviously are going to affect that leadership, as opposed to, you know, as you were explaining, a system in which a person is chosen based on their own merits.
On their own merits,
and
yes.
Remember, the supreme leader is somebody that comes and is chosen. It's an indirect election.
Yes.
The people elect the Assembly of Experts.
And the experts.
And the Assembly of Experts, you know, appoint. Select a supreme leader.
Supreme leader.
And they're able to, you know, which you can't, I mean, with a king, what are you going to do? You can't impeach a king, right?
No, you can't. Yes. I remember that since Charles the First.
Right. Yes. So, you know, this is a problem with having kings is, you know, once you got them, you got them.
You can't get rid of them until death do us part.
How long has, you know, Elizabeth been around? I
mean, oh, she's been around for a long time. You know, this is why Charles weeps, you know. He really cries, you know. He wants mother off that throne as soon as possible,
right.
You know.
So, you know, this is what we're talking about. We haven't even mentioned places like, you know, Saudi Arabia. We haven't mentioned places.
Yeah. It's our favorite topic. But
you know,
we haven't mentioned, you know, some of these hereditary kings, like Azerbaijan hereditary presidents.
Their
hereditary line doesn't go that far
right.
back.
So there, I would categorize them. I mean, obviously, Saudi Arabia is a monarchy, but I mean, I would categorize, you know, it's the same principle that we're talking about.
Exactly. That's true.
But the unfortunate thing is that you have in the West a society and a civilization which actually did value moral leadership at some point.
At some point, that's true.
You know, where you have examples of that in its history where you really had people. And, of course, you have it in the East as well. You have it, you know, we were talking about one of the khalifas, which was, you know, Umar bin Abdul Aziz, who was considered one of the good khalifas. You know, this is something that's really apparent in the West now.
I think so.
If you look at...
I think this crisis has reached rock bottom, as they say, you know.
Yeah, and it has to do with the rise of basically this complete plutocracy, this kind of complete
rule of the wealth,
exactly, and rule of money, and this kind of domination of the whole system by money,
by
and
banks
and special interests.
Yes,
you
special
know?
Interests. Yes.
And when we're talking about special interests, obviously, when we talk about, you know, money, Zionism is right there.
Well, I mean, it's right there. I mean, right. They've all got those names, haven't they? You know,
I
don't want to go into that.
Right. What I'm trying to say is that this doesn't
Lehman, you know.
Right. What I'm trying to say is that this is together. You know, the fact that you would have a large, huge nation like the United States, 300 million people, not being able to pursue its own interests in the Middle East because of Israel or because of Al-Saud.
Yes.
And again, we've talked about this many times, but it bears repeating, which is that, you know, it would be in the interests of the American people
to do something in the interest of America.
To have good relations with Iran, for example.
Wow.
You know?
That would
be
nice.
To actually, you know, say, you know what? Let's bury the hatchet. Mm. You know, let's start it. You know, we recognize that you had a revolution. You know, fine. You kick the, you know, our guy out. That's okay.
Yes.
It's ancient history, as the Americans say. You know.
Sure.
You know, let's get on with it. Let bygones be bygones. Let's get on with it.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, that would be in the interests of the American people. It would be in the interests of even the American elites.
Sure.
But unfortunately, you have, you know, the Israel lobby. You have the Saudi lobby, which doesn't allow American elites to make that move.
Well, the other thing...
And they don't have the courage to tell, you know, foreigners,
like the Israelis or the Saudis,
hey, back off. This is our national interest.
Sure, but their short-term interests are in congruence with each other, aren't they?
Absolutely correct. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's the key point, which you were pointing out, which is that this is why the leadership can't do it, because they're only thinking short-term.
Yes.
They're thinking next elections. They're thinking Congress. They're thinking, you know...
My pocket, basically.
Right.
Yes.
You know, how are we going to get the funding? They're thinking, you know, media campaign. What's Fox News going to say? What's MSNBC going to say?
Exactly. It's all about image and so many other things.
Right, which is why we mentioned the example of Nixon.
That's right.
You know, Nixon, being a conservative Republican anti-communist, you know, gets up and goes to communist China.
Yeah.
And says, you know what, we're not going to recognize Taiwan,
sure.
the nationalist Chinese government, any longer. Mm. You know, it's a little island with a couple million versus, you know, this massive
continent.
Right.
Yes,
yes, it's true. Mm. It helped the Americans in fighting the Soviets and creating a tripolar situation.
Sure.
In order to pit the Chinese against the Soviets. But still, you know, here you had a guy who you would not expect to have been friendly with communists in communist China.
Sure. And but yet, he was basically doing it in the American interest.
But
wasn't
he realized that this is in the American interest. And he stood up against the people in his own party.
Of course, who were deadly against it.
Right. Yeah. So this is what we talk about when we talk about leadership. Mm. Okay, you can call it, I don't know if I would call that moral leadership, what Nixon did, but it was
more visionary.
It was a kind of leadership.
Yes. Yes.
You know what I mean?
Better than George Bush Jr.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Or if you look at somebody, I mean, look, I'm trying to, you know, just bring examples. There's a lot of, you can, you know, make a lot of complaints about these examples. But you have somebody like Lyndon Johnson, you know, who's from Texas, from the South. He's a Southern white, you know, growing up in that segregation environment. And yet he stands up for civil rights.
He was hands up for civil rights.
Right.
Yes.
So, you know, these are things,
there were these
that,
things.
And again, it might have not been easy for him to do that.
Sure. In the last minute or so, Dr. Turabi, just sum up for us, really, you know, this crisis of leadership in the West.
Well, to sum it up, it's very simple.
Yes.
You have a system which is an Islamic system versus a secular system.
That's true.
In Islam, we say that the leader of a society has to himself be a moral person.
That's right.
Has to be a just person themselves in their own lives.
That's right.
Okay.
Personally, they must reflect that.
This is the difference. Mm. In secularism, they say if he is, that's good.
That's good.
But
that's
if he
bonus.
Isn't, yeah. But if he isn't, if he isn't, he is.
Right.
That's basically what the difference is.
Sure.
You have a leadership system being presented in Islam in the time when the Prophet, peace be upon him, and the Imams are not present, which is the Walayat Faqih. The leadership of the
jurisprudent,
who is the one that is able to guide society as an expert in law. And law in Islam is not the law of the West. Law is a manifestation of divine right and wrong.
Divine right and wrong.
Okay? In Islam, when we talk about Sharia, when we talk about laws, fiqh, faqih, this is a manifestation of what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is bad, as defined by the Creator. So we need a person who's there to guide society on this path.
Sure. Thank you very much, Dr. Mahdi Turabi, for your valuable contribution on the program today. It certainly enlightened us a lot about what is the reality of the crisis of leadership in the West. But thanks very much for that. And it just leaves me to say for our audience, Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you very much for listening to our program today. Goodbye.
Everyone, welcome back to the light. Thai brides and grooms have said, I do, in a special wedding ceremony on Valentine's Day. 59 couples tied the knot on elephants during the ceremony in Thailand's Chonburi province. The elephant bag wedding is actually an annual event. It takes place in a botanical garden. In previous years, over 100 couples attended the ceremony. But this year, the number was half that due to the pandemic.
Humans are not the only ones having fun with snowfall. Two giant baby pandas at a Belgian zoo are also taking the advantage of the winter and having a blast playing in the snow. Bao Di and Bao Mi, translated as a little brother of Bao and little sister of Bao, were caught on camera enjoying their first winter at Pairi Diaza. The overly excited, adorable babies were rolling, tumbling around, and even eating in the snow. The zookeeper says that the body of the pandas is in a shape that makes them comfortable in the cold. With the birth of these two babies in August 2019, the privately owned Belgian zoo is now home to five giant pandas. Pairi Diaza is called Europe's best zoo, which consists of botanical garden and an animal theme park.
Chinese villagers cook local dishes as they mark the start of the Lunar New Year. The Chinese New Year is celebrated throughout East Asia and has always been the most important holiday of the year in that region of the world. For many people, it's a two-week celebration culminating in fireworks, red envelopes with gifts, and most importantly, a sumptuous feast. Their elaborate meal preparation allows the family to spend more time together and celebrate the new year.
When the children come back from work, they want to taste the foods cooked by their mother. That's a flavor for the Lunar New Year.
The auspicious symbolism of these traditional foods is based on their pronunciations or appearances. Not only do the dishes themselves matter, but the preparation and ways of serving and even enjoying them mean a lot. In the northwestern province of Shaanxi, villagers use a 3,000-year-old recipe to make humo, a kind of floury steamed bun in a variety of festive shapes, including Chinese zodiacs. 2021 is the lunar year of ox. Australia is offering environmentally friendly kayak tours in Sydney Harbour to both entertain participants and help clean up the ocean. The tours offer paddles, buckets, sieves and picker sticks for removing trash from the harbour. Each month about 20 such tours take place. They collect around 200 kilograms of garbage. Organisers believe big changes can be made with these tiny steps.
I do feel like we make a difference. It's not. I don't feel like it's just about the rubbish that we pick up, but I feel like it's about sharing a message of what we're doing and I guess teaching people about recycling, using less plastic. I think a lot of people walk around the boardwalk and think that Sydney Harbour is beautiful and pristine, and it is a very clean waterway compared to others in the world, but once you're down here in a kayak or if you go for a swim, you really notice just how much rubbish is down there, so I think it opens people's eyes up.
Plastic pollution has a direct and deadly effect on wildlife. According to the United Nations Environment Programme, 8 million tons of plastic goes into the ocean globally each year. Experts say that by 2050, there will be more plastic than fish in the ocean. People throughout China and in many countries across the globe have begun celebrations marking the start of Chinese Lunar New Year, also known as the Spring Festival. February the 12th is the beginning of the Year of the Ox, based on the Chinese calendar. A variety of activities featuring traditional Chinese culture and folk performances mark the occasion in China and neighboring states Malaysia, Japan, and Vietnam. Releasing lanterns and setting off fireworks are part of the event. It's also the time for families to be together as the day starts with a week-long official public holiday. The festive mood is also seen in Europe as well as in Australia. Sydney was one of the first cities to kick off celebrations.
It's meant to be a year of economic prosperity, which we need after COVID, a year of good health, which we need so we can, you know, mix and get back to a normal way of life. But it would be good if we had good relations with all of our neighbours.
The Italian city of Milan also joined the celebrations, with its highest building being lit up in red for the fourth consecutive year. Every year, millions of people in China and elsewhere in the world welcome and celebrate the Spring Festival. The occasion attracts hundreds of thousands of tourists to China. However, border closures and travel bans due to the COVID-19 pandemic have reduced the crowd this year, forcing many people to sit home and watch the festivities online. A Canadian man has made art by drawing magnificent geometric shapes on snow-covered fields and frozen lakes. Kim Asmussen first draws a sketch with the help of designing software. Then he puts on his snowshoes to stomp around and make squares, circles and triangulars, among others. Asmussen says 15 to 30 centimeters of snow is needed to make out a design. The man uses a compass and a rope to complete his project. Friends help him too. He began his work last year near Ontario and has so far created 20 snowshoe artworks. The biggest one is around 400 meters long.
Annually, China bursts with colors and lights when the Lunar New Year arrives. This time, an artist has created a gigantic colorful sculpture to welcome the happy occasion. Hu Xingming used clay to make a sculpture of an ox this year, the symbol of the Chinese zodiac calendar. The artwork is the largest of its kind in all of China. It is almost 5 meters long and stands 3 meters tall. Hu says that the piece aims to lift the spirits as his country is battling the coronavirus pandemic.
In the new year, we want to use this ox image to encourage people to win the battle against the coronavirus and get rid of the shadow of the epidemic. We also want to use the flourishing colored ox sculpture to wish our country all the best for its development in the new year.
It took Hu more than 40 days to complete his radiant sculpture. It is adorned with designs that are believed to bring good luck in Chinese culture, such as pomegranates and peaches. The artist says that he will put the ox in public square in his city so that visitors can enjoy the spectacle ahead of the Lunar New Year, which falls on the 12th of February.
A German clinic has trained sniffer dogs to detect coronavirus in human saliva samples with 94% accuracy. Philal, a 3-year-old Belgian shepherd, and Joe Cocker, a 1-year-old Cocker Spaniel, can smell the corona odor that comes from cells in infected people. It's not the virus sending out the odor, but the cell infected with the virus. The clinic's director says the dog's unrivaled sense can enable them to even sniff out COVID patients without any symptoms. Further feasibility tests are required before the sniffer dogs can be put to use in everyday life.
Well, no matter how old you are, music can always be mesmerizing. In France, a pianist is still addicted to the soft tune of her instrument at the age of 106. Here's more. Colette Mays is a pianist based in Paris. She was born before the start of the First World War and has been playing her favorite instrument for more than a century now. Colette has already released 5 music albums and is now recording her 6th one. The veteran musician says what attracted her to music was a desire for tenderness, which she lacked as a kid at her strict home environment.
In my family, I was raised by a very kind nanny. Mother was very strict. That's how it was at the time, and so I needed tenderness, which was normal. Above where we lived, there were lots of little boys who played the piano. They were always playing the same music. And as a baby, with one finger, I reproduced those melodies. My parents were surprised with that, because playing with dolls didn't amuse me, but playing notes on the piano did. That's why they made me start learning the piano early on.
Well, Colette's favorite musicians are Debussy, Chopin, and Schumann. She looks at the sky for inspiration and says music is more important to her than food. For most of her adult life, Colette has been a supporting piano player at Parisian schools. The dedicated pianist is still marvelously healthy at the age of 106.
Madagascar is the land of outlandish creatures. Biologists have made another tiny discovery in the north of the island. Scientists say Bruchesia nana could be the world's smallest reptile. Also known as nanochameleon, the diminutive lizard measures less than an inch in length. That means it is as small as a sunflower seed and can fit on your fingertip. The reptilian may be tiny, but it has raised a lot of questions as to why it is this small compared to other vertebrates. Also, unlike most reptiles, female nanochameleons are larger than the males. The species is thought to be critically endangered due to mass deforestation.
That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
Oh! Nairobi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In recent years, images of whales and sea turtles starving to death after ingesting plastic waste or becoming entangled in so-called ghost nets have led to a growing awareness of the crisis of marine plastic pollution. The total number of plastic bags, fishing equipment, disposable bottles and other plastic items currently in the ocean is unknown. However, studies show that plastic waste has become ubiquitous, from the Arctic to the Antarctic, from the surface to the bottom of the deep seas. We're prepared for you an article written by researchers at the Institute for Advanced Sustainability Studies. The piece is titled Recommendations for Regional Action to Combat Marine Plastic Pollution. The article has been published by phys.org website. Please stay with us for more. Millions of tons of plastic waste find their way into the ocean every year. A team of researchers from the Institute for Advanced Sustainability Studies in Potsdam, Germany, has investigated the role of regional ocean governance in the fight against marine plastic pollution, highlighting why regional marine governance should be further strengthened as negotiations for a new global agreement continue. In recent years, images of whales and sea turtles starving to death after ingesting plastic waste or becoming entangled in so-called ghost nets have led to a growing awareness of the crisis of marine plastic pollution. The total number of plastic bags, fishing equipment, disposable bottles and other plastic items currently in the oceans is unknown. However, studies show that plastic waste has become ubiquitous, from the Arctic to the Antarctic, from the surface to the bottom of the deep seas. It comes in all shapes and all sizes, from vast fishing nets to tiny particles of microplastic. The authors of the new report published by the Institute for Advanced Sustainability Studies, IASS, Stronger Together, the Role of Regional Instruments in Strengthening Global Governance of Marine Plastic Pollution, wrote, various agreements have been reached at the national, regional, and global levels to tackle the issue. However, these measures have failed to effectively address the challenges around marine plastic pollution. More comprehensive measures and systemic changes are urgently needed to reduce and prevent marine plastic pollution. The issue is all the more urgent as the amount of plastic manufactured globally is expected to double in the next 10 to 15 years. According to the new report, the key challenges for the further development of existing initiatives to combat plastic waste in marine regions such as the Baltic Sea, the Pacific Ocean, or the Caribbean Sea include 1. A great variation in the level of implementation of measures to address plastic pollution. 2. Large differences in the monitoring and assessment of relevant data. 3. Deficits in the implementation of multi-stakeholder approaches. And 4, a widespread lack of engagement with the private sector. According to a new report, private sector engagement is crucial to reducing the flow of plastic waste into the seas. The authors recommend that regional working groups be established to foster cooperation. The Institute for Advanced Sustainability Studies, IASS researcher and lead author of the report, Nicole Weinrich, said, "Working groups would provide a forum for organizations that are committed to marine conservation to engage with private companies and discuss how the discharge of plastic waste into the seas can be prevented by, for example, using alternative materials in manufacturing or improving waste management systems. Measures should be tailored towards establishing a circular economy with a waste hierarchy based on the principle of reduce, reuse, and recycle. A global agreement could establish common goals and minimum standards." The report also highlights the need to improve data collection around marine plastic pollution. Various organizations maintain records on the extent of plastic waste flowing into the oceans. The Institute for Advanced Sustainability Studies, IASS researcher Laura Weyand, who contributed to the study, explained, "The lack of common standards and methods for data collection makes it difficult to draw comparisons across data sets and reduces their utility." Regular and long-term monitoring would be necessary to detect differences in the nature and volume of plastic waste flows into the seas and oceans. Only then could organizations determine whether measures are successful and have the desired effect. A global agreement to address the issue of marine plastic pollution could establish a common framework for data collection and for data assessment. Innovative methods should be used to collect data on marine plastic pollution. Citizen science projects involving local populations could also help to collect the necessary data. In addition, drones, unmanned aircraft, and satellite images could all be used to simplify data collection and provide insights on waste volumes on remote areas such as the high seas. Regional organizations provide a vital opportunity to address the issue of marine plastic pollution at the ecosystem level. They can also facilitate the development and implementation of solutions that are tailored to address the challenges, the needs, and the characteristic features of different regions and affected countries. They also create opportunities to exceed the standards set by a new global agreement, with ambitious regional agreements which can inspire further action around the world. As negotiations for a global agreement continue, the team of authors of the new report recommends that regional cooperation to prevent marine plastic pollution be strengthened further, not least because these negotiations could well continue for several years. Sebastian Unger, research group leader at the Institute for Advanced Sustainability Studies, IASS, says, "We can't wait that long and simply accept the status quo. This problem is too big and it's too urgent."
September 1978, U.S. President Jimmy Carter, who was really concerned about peace and security in the world, invited the two sides of a major conflict to a meeting. His guests were Anwar al-Sadat, President of Egypt, and former fighter, the Prime Minister of Israel, Menachem Begin. After 30 years of fruitless Arab-Israeli wars, both sides preferred to talk secretly about the conflict for a few days. The secret talks needed a comfortable place, and it was situated in Washington Northwest Road on top of the forested hills. It was Camp David, the country retreat for the President of the United States. It is a place filled with trees, good weather, and also important secrets. Of course, this was not the first time that the United States held itself accountable for Israel. Jimmy Carter was not the only one who had this sense of responsibility in U.S. government. The first and perhaps most responsible U.S. president on the Palestinian issue was Harry S. Truman. The most important place to express this sense of responsibility was in the United Nations General Assembly to divide Palestine into two independent states, Arab and Jewish. It was possible to create a nation with the vote of the majority and give them land in the same place.
Those who are in favor will say yes, those who are against will say no.
Afghanistan, no. Argentina, Argentina, abstention. Egypt, no. Iraq, no. Lebanon, no. Soviet Union, yes.
United Kingdom, abstain. United States, yes. Paraguay, yes.
The resolution of the Duck Committee for Palestine was adopted by 33 votes, 13 against, 10 abstentions.
Israeli flag was hoisted outside the United Nations just after this session. When the UN General Assembly voted on the partition plan for Palestine, the Zionists did not keep the great powers waiting. The representative of the Jewish agency at the UN told the members of the Security Council what they were waiting for.
Not later than May 16th next, a provisional Jewish government will commence to function in cooperation with the representatives of the United Nations then in Palestine.
But at the first step, the White House acted against the Zionist expectations.
America, it's hard.
The U.S. State Department argued against it. Their first response was, no country, no state.
The situation was not good at all, so the Prime Minister of Israel, Moshe Sharet, was sent to the United States so that he might be able to change the strong-willed United States Secretary of State's opinion on the recognition of the State of Israel. But George Marshall did not agree at all. Marshall went to the White House to talk to Harry S. Truman, and he realized that the president did not agree with him and had different ideas about Israel. Clark Clifford, the White House counsel, was also present in that meeting.
General Marshall started off. The president listened attentively and then said, I would like now to hear from Clark. But as I spoke, I saw Marshall's face getting redder
George Marshall realized that Truman supported Israel for two reasons: Zionist money and votes in the upcoming elections. And Truman mentioned this point explicitly. However, Marshall tried to make Truman aware of the consequences of his decision.
We are in the midst of a very critical situation. We should therefore carefully avoid approaching international problems on an emotional basis.
Finally, Marshall said that if Truman recognized the Israeli interim government, he would not support his candidacy in the upcoming elections. But 2 days later, on May 14, 1948, the leaders of the Jewish National Council went to this building, the Tel Aviv Museum, to proclaim the establishment of an independent Jewish state. Shortly before this announcement, Eliyahu Epstein, head of the Jewish Agency in Washington, wrote to the U.S. president that the Act of Independence would become effective at 1 minute after 6 p.m. on May 14, 1948, Washington time. With full knowledge of the deep bond of sympathy which has existed and has been strengthened over the past 30 years between the government of the United States and the Jewish people of Palestine, I have been authorized by the provisional government of the new state to tender this message and to express the hope that your government will recognize and will welcome Israel into the community of nations. Later, just 11 minutes past 6 p.m., Harry Truman wrote to the UN General Assembly despite George Marshall's disagreements.
This government has been informed that a Jewish state has been proclaimed in Palestine and recognition has been requested by the provisional government thereof. The United States recognizes the provisional government as the de facto authority of the new state of Israel.
Happiness of forming a Jewish homeland on the promised land did not last long. The very next day, when David Ben-Gurion read the Declaration of Independence at the Tel Aviv Museum, Egypt, Jordan, Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria, angry with their new uninvited neighbor, attacked Israel. The fledgling Israel had no aircraft nor tanks, and the Arabs were superior against the Zionists in the number of fighters and arms, and their victory seemed certain. The same theory turned into reality, and the Arabs achieved significant victories. The Zionists saw with their own eyes that the Jewish homeland was on the edge of destruction. David Ben-Gurion and his companions had to do something, so they went around the world to buy weapons. Finally, Czechoslovakia and Russia sold arms to Israel. The weapons of the Eastern Bloc changed the equation of power on the battlefield. Arabs were optimistic and participated with part of their power in the war, but they were unsuccessful. The UN was under the US pressure to declare a ceasefire to end the Arab-Israeli conflict and pressured the Arabs to sign a ceasefire agreement with Israel. After 9 months of fighting in vain, the ceasefire put an end to the conflict. The Arabs did not accept the peace agreement with Israel because peace meant the recognition of the State of Israel. The Arabs accepted the ceasefire, not peace.
The next Arab-Israeli dispute was over a waterway built in 1869 in Egypt. This canal connected Port Said on the Mediterranean coast to the Gulf of Suez in the Red Sea. This waterway later became known as the Suez Canal. The canal was built so that ships traveling from the west to the ports of the east of the world would not have to go around the African continent. The Suez Canal Company was owned by Britain for many years, but the new Egyptian president, Gamal Abdel Nasser, gave a fervent speech on July the 26th, 1956, in Alexandria, announcing the nationalization of the Suez Canal Company. Then he raised the flag of his country in that region as the sign of this nationalization. All assets of Suez International Company, most of which belonged to Britain and France, were frozen. The French, who resented the Egyptian aid to the Algerian revolutionaries, in addition to the Suez affair, held a secret meeting in Paris with the British, who had been deprived of the huge Suez Canal shipping revenue. This top-secret meeting had a very special guest, Israeli representative Shimon Peres. The French and British believed that they had to inveigle Israel into invading Egypt in order to take revenge on Gamal Abdel Nasser. They knew that Nasser banned Israeli ships and planes from passing through the Strait of Tiran a year earlier in 1955, and this act could have provoked Israel to attack Egypt. Their ideas attracted Peres's attention, and he soon returned to Israel to inform David Ben-Gurion of their secret offer. Ben-Gurion began working on the plan and was sure that it could alleviate the situation. Nasser predicted the war and asked the United States to buy weapons. But Washington refused it because of the 1950 tripartite agreement on the Middle East among the US, France, and Britain. The agreement banned selling arms to countries in the region to prevent an arms race. So Gamal Abdel Nasser reached out to the Soviet Union for economic and military assistance. Czechoslovakia agreed to give arms to Egypt. The proximity of Egypt and the Eastern Bloc could have intensified the Cold War. On October the 29th, 1956, the Israelis invaded the Sinai Desert. A week later, they occupied it. French fighter jets also provided security for Israeli ground forces in Sinai against the powerful Egyptian Air Force. Israel ignored the importance of power. The United States, which was furious with Israel over its alliance with France and Britain, repeatedly pressured the United Nations Security Council to do something about a temporary ceasefire. On October the 13th, the UN Security Council convened and voted on a draft resolution urging Israel to withdraw its forces to establish a temporary ceasefire. But the resolution was vetoed by France and Britain, and the Soviet Union proposed a similar resolution that had no better fate than the previous one. Dwight D. Eisenhower, then President of the United States, appeared on camera and spoke on behalf of his nation.
The United States was not consulted in any way about any phase of these actions, nor were we informed of them in advance. In the circumstances I have described, there will be no United States involvement in these present hostilities. I therefore have no plan to call the Congress in special session. Of course, we shall continue to keep in contact with congressional leaders of both parties. It is our hope and intent that the this matter will be brought before the United Nations General Assembly. There, with no veto operating, the opinion of the world can be brought to bear in our quest for a just end to this tormenting problem. In the past, the United Nations has proved able to find a way to end bloodshed. We believe it can and that it will do so again.
The dispute between the permanent members of the Security Council over the ceasefire was not resolved, and as a result, the UN General Assembly convened a special emergency meeting at the request of the Security Council and issued the ceasefire order by 57 votes. But France and Britain ignored the decree. When Nikolai Bulganin, the Soviet Prime Minister, noted the situation of his communist ally, issued an ultimatum to France and Britain to destroy London and Paris with atomic bombs if they did not stop invading Egypt. The next day, the military offensive against Egypt ceased. On November the 14th, the first UN peacekeeping troops were deployed in the area, so the Israeli forces left Sinai. The UN flag established a 10-year ceasefire between Egypt and Israel. This fruitless retreat benefited Abdel Nasser more than anyone else. Nasser was about to become an irreplaceable hero of Arab dreams. In May 1967, when Egyptian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Anwar al-Sadat went to Moscow to meet the Soviet Prime Minister, Alexei Kosygin, he was secretly told that Israel had gathered all its forces on the Syrian border. Anwar al-Sadat was asked to inform Abdel Nasser, the man who became the hero of the Arabs by nationalizing the Suez Canal. This mischievous news from the Russians was in fact a kind of incitement to provoke Egypt to attack Israel. The Soviet Union liked to witness a war in the Middle East, so the power in East and West would be in favor of the communists.
Мы думали, что в политическом плане, даже если война закончится в ничью,
we believed a war could bring us political gains. Even a stalemate could bring us benefits. Egypt had our backing, both political and military. We thought their forces would demonstrate the benefits of Soviet support. So we were confident that the balance of power in the Middle East would be altered by a localized war.
The Egyptian army did not report any movements on the Syrian-Israeli border, but the Russians again confirmed the news. In any case, Nasser did not take the risk and ordered his defense minister, Abdel Hakim Amer, to be ready to attack Israel if Israel invaded Syria. Russia's plan to start a war in the Middle East was turning into reality. Abdel Nasser wrote a letter to the United Nations calling for the withdrawal of peacekeeper troops stationed on the Israeli-Egyptian border since the nationalization of the Suez Canal so that the Egyptian army could take stand. This measure drew all the attention to Sharm el-Sheikh port in Sinai. Egypt took the initiative and closed the Strait of Tiran in the Gulf of Aqaba again. By doing so, the Zionists' water connection with the east of the world was completely cut off. Egypt blocked the only way for Israeli oil transfer, and that meant the declaration of war.
Our armed forces are ready for war. The Gulf of Aqaba belongs to Egypt. There is no way that we will allow Israeli ships to pass through. The Jews are threatening war. We tell them hello and welcome. We are ready for war. But there is no way we will give up our rights to the Gulf of Aqaba.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
New York prosecutors are investigating financial dealings around some of former President Donald Trump's signature Manhattan properties, extending the known range of the criminal probe of the former president and his company, according to people familiar with the matter. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Wall Street Journal columnists Corinne Ramey and Emily Grazer. The piece is titled New York Prosecutors Investigating Trump's Manhattan Properties. New York prosecutors are investigating financial dealings around some of Donald Trump's signature Manhattan properties, extending the known range of the criminal probe of the former president and his company, according to people familiar with the matter. Officials are investigating loans the former president Donald J. Trump took on four buildings, including his flagship Trump Tower in New York. According to people familiar with the matter, Manhattan prosecutors are examining loans Donald Trump took out on his flagship Fifth Avenue building, Trump Tower, on 40 Wall Street, an Art Deco skyscraper in New York City's financial district, on Trump International Hotel and Tower, a hotel and condominium building at Columbus Circle, and Trump Plaza, an apartment building on Manhattan's East Side. All of the loans under scrutiny were made to Donald Trump by subsidiaries of Ladder Capital Corp, a New York City-based real estate investment trust, the people said. Since 2012, Ladder Capital has lent Donald Trump more than $280 million for the four Manhattan buildings, according to property records. Lawyers for Mr. Trump and the Trump Organization declined to comment. Donald Trump has called the probe a partisan witch hunt led by Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance Jr., a Democrat. Mr. Trump's lawyers have called the investigation a fishing expedition in Mr. Vance's bid to get the former president's tax returns. Mr. Vance's office has said in court filings that it is pursuing a complex investigation into alleged insurance and bank fraud by the Trump Organization and its top officers. Investigations appear to be an extension of a previously acknowledged move by Manhattan's Democratic District Attorney, Cyrus Vance Jr., over what prosecutors have called possibly extensive and protracted criminal conduct at the Trump Organization. Donald Trump has described the New York investigation, triggered by an alleged $130,000 hush money payment to former model and film star Stormy Daniels over an alleged sexual liaison, as a continuation of the worst witch hunt in American history. Investigators, the Wall Street Journal reported, could be looking for disparities between loan documents and declared insurance valuations or even tax returns. Donald Trump took out a $100 million loan against Trump Tower in 2012, according to the Wall Street Journal. The journal added that in the next 3 years, he took out $15 million against Trump Plaza, the Upper East Side property, $160 million against 40 Wall Street, and $7 million against Trump International Hotel and Tower on Central Park South. The Wall Street Journal reported that the loans were advanced by subsidiaries of Ladder Capital, a real estate investment trust which employs Jack Weiselberg, son of Donald Trump Organization Chief Financial Officer Alan Weiselberg. Neither has been accused of wrongdoing. In 2018, the older Weiselberg was granted immunity to testify in the hush money investigation. By avoiding conviction in his second impeachment trial, Donald Trump remained free to run for office again. But without the protections of office, he's vulnerable to prosecution. The New York State Attorney General, Cyrus Vance Jr., is also investigating the Trump Organization. The Wall Street Journal reported that the Trump Tower loan will come due in 2022, and other loans are due over the next several years. The Manhattan District Attorney, Cyrus Vance Jr., did not confirm any expansion of the investigation to the Wall Street Journal.
Economic divide.
Hello, welcome to Economic Divide with Nico Vitafleo. On this week's show, we'll be looking at the economic war between China and the U.S., particularly focusing on the tussle for the top of the world's largest economy ladder, something that appears to be about to change. Will the impact of the COVID-19 virus has, of course, played its part in the world's economy, yet it seems that the recovery time from the depression caused is something that could be a factor in just how individual economies pick up again, with China seeming to lead the way as it bounces back from the financial impact seen in the year 2020. But it's not just the COVID-19 pandemic that has seen economies rise and fall. As from back in 2010, the Chinese economy began to exponentially gain on the U.S. economy, as we can see in this chart from the CEBR World Economic League table, which also shows that by the year 2028, the Chinese economy will catch up with and surpass that of the U.S.